From Melman Consulting, this is 14th and G, the podcast at the intersection of business, politics, and culture, coming to you from the heart of Washington, D.C.
Well, I'm really happy to have Hal Brands back, one of our favorite geopolitical brains in the world. And our regulars, Hal, value your books, and we always have you when you have a new book out and your insights. And I know you and I have been plotting at coffee houses to maybe try to start doing this more regularly, even if it doesn't require a new book from you. But obviously, the recent war in Iran has created so many questions, and I don't know anybody likelier to have great answers that I'm grateful and thrilled you were available to join us. So thank you.
Thanks for having me, man. I always enjoy this, and I look forward to a good conversation.
Let's start with the basics, man. Why did we attack Iran, and why did it have to happen now?
So that I think, is in some ways the most interesting question we're going to talk about. And so the way I would frame it is that this was coming, this being some sort of military operation, maybe an Israeli operation, maybe an Israeli operation supported and joined by the U.S., to essentially mow the lawn, to prevent Iran from rebuilding capabilities, whether nuclear capabilities or missile capabilities or other military capabilities that the U.S. and Iran had damaged or destroyed back in the June war. And so if you think back to late December, the story was that Bibi Netanyahu had gone to Mar-a-Lago and had asked for Trump's support if and when this was going to happen. I don't think he had in mind that it was going to happen in February. I think he was thinking about something later this year. Then you get Iranian protesters out in the street. Trump basically says hands off to the regime. The regime ignores him and kills in brutal fashion a whole bunch of people. And that essentially drags the whole crisis forward by a few months, in my estimation. And so Trump wasn't able to strike Iran in January when it ran across his don't kill protesters red line because the U.S. military just wasn't ready. It wasn't postured to do it. We didn't have the things in the Middle East to really deliver a harsh blow and then withstand the Iranian response. And so then over the next 6 weeks, you see the buildup that brought us to where we were last weekend. And then the timing of the strike itself was apparently brought about by some exquisite intelligence that there would be one or more gatherings of high-level Iranian leaders on early Saturday morning, our time. And as we know, the Israelis were able to get the supreme leader and about 40 of his top officials in the space of a minute or two at the beginning of the war while the U.S. started striking military targets. So that's how it started. And I think that explains most of the timing.
That actually makes sense and was clear. Thanks. I can think of a few jobs that people should hire you for. The next biggest, most important question: how do we get out? When is it possible?
Yeah. So my guess. So far, the administration has said this is going to take weeks or perhaps longer. 4 to 5 weeks was what Trump said over the weekend. You've seen similar comments. That may be true. It may also be posturing in the sense of trying to convince Iran that it can't outlast the United States. My guess is you're going to see this go at really high intensity, another 10 days, another 2 weeks, something like that. And then people will start wondering how this ends. And that will be related to a couple of factors. The first is, has the damage from the war continued to accumulate in the way it started to accumulate in the first couple of days? And by the damage, I don't mean the damage to Iran. I mean the damage to the region. I mean the damage to the global economy. I mean the potential damage to President Trump politically. As things stand right now, there's not much getting through the Strait of Hormuz. You got about 20% of the world's oil that flows through there, big chunks of natural gas as well. And that is already having a powerful economic impact on U.S. allies in Europe and Northeast Asia, even though the impact has been a little bit less pronounced in the United States. So I think the clock is running in terms of the ability to either mitigate that disruption, and we can talk about what some of those measures might be, or to start looking for an off-ramp. The second critical variable is exactly how far the United States decides to take this in terms of its objectives. So when Trump gave his first remarks on this and that video that was released early Saturday morning, he listed a series of essentially military objectives: crush the Iranian Navy, make sure they can never have a nuclear weapon, take out the missile program, so on and so forth. And then added sort of aspirationally, and Iran should have a new regime. I think you can accomplish a lot of the first things on that list, the military objectives, in the space of, you know, somewhere between 10 days and a few weeks. If you're trying to bring about a new regime, that's probably going to take longer, and it may require you to do things like giving air support to, you know, Kurdish rebels in Iran, or if you get the protesters back out in the street, and things like that. And so those are the sort of things that could extend the clock. My guess is that President Trump is going to be looking for an exit from this conflict sooner rather than later, like weeks, not months, because it becomes more economically and politically costly for him. The question finally is whether there are dramatic things that the president might try to do to accelerate a resolution of the conflict. So a lot of Iran's oil exports flow through a single island in the Persian Gulf. It's not very big. It's the sort of thing where conceivably you could send some American troops to occupy that territory. And because it's an island, it's easier to defend than if you're, you know, somewhere on sort of the mainland of Iran. That's the sort of thing that might appeal to Trump, because it would give the U.S. powerful coercive leverage. It would be sort of taking the oil, so to speak, which is an idea we know that he is attracted to in other contexts. And so those are some of the endgames. And then I guess the biggest question is kind of like, if this regime goes in Iran, what comes next? And I think what's very unlikely to come next is a stable democracy. You could get a continuation of the current regime with a little bit more tactical flexibility in its dealings with the United States. That's possible. You could get a takeover by folks who are more hardline than before. There's some evidence to suggest that the Supreme Leader Khamenei was actually standing in the way of folks in the IRGC who had a more radical bent in foreign policy. Or you could get chaos, right? You could get a civil war scenario. You know, we can talk about which of those outcomes are better than others, but I think the outcome that we all might like to see, which is representative government, a very friendly attitude toward the Western United States, that may be the least likely of the bunch.
You talked about some number of weeks as opposed to longer as a viable amount of time for the U.S. and Israel to meaningfully either diminish or destroy Iranian capabilities to create drones, to you know, exactly how much of their potential offensive stuff is knowable, findable, and genuinely destroyable, as opposed to how much can they just secret underground. In the same way, you're not going to get rid of all of those paramilitary guys and their guns who killed 30,000 a couple of weeks ago, and who, if and when there is a resistance regime, they all got their guns, and no amount of bombing is going to go get individuals. Is it realistic to hope that we can take out their capacity to strike targets outside of Iran over the next couple of weeks?
I think we can do a lot of damage to it. I don't know that we can destroy every Iranian attack drone that's being used to go after tankers in the Persian Gulf or the UAE, which is really absorbing the brunt of this in a lot of ways. You know, we might not be able to destroy every mobile missile launcher that the Iranians have, although we seem to be doing, in coordination with the Israelis, a pretty good job of destroying the ones that we can find right now. We can probably destroy a lot of the military industrial targets, so that, you know, the factories that produce things, that either produce weapons or the things that go into weapons, all of that can be rebuilt, of course. We can destroy command and control mechanisms of the military and what you might think of as the repressive apparatus, IRGC headquarters, headquarters of the Basij militias that are often involved in repressing the populations. You have reports that you know, the Israelis are even striking police stations in certain parts of Iran to try to make it difficult for the regime to control the population. You know, can you fundamentally break the repressive apparatus in a way that prevents it from shooting people when they come out in the streets? I don't know. I think that's harder. And I think a lot of it depends more on kind of the mentality of the elites in charge of the regime than it does sort of how many people you can kill and how many, you know, AK-47s you can take off of the battlefield. The U.S. and Israel, the bottom line here, they can do a heck of a lot of damage to Iran's ability to project power. Like most of the Iranian Navy is now sitting on the bottom of the ocean. You know, Iran is going to have far less capacity to launch missiles against other countries than it did in the past. But I don't know that you can sort of permanently erase any of this stuff. And so the question is sort of, even if you do a really, really good job of suppressing Iran's capabilities, if a regime that is hostile to you remains in place, the threat may still be there, and it'll be less for a little while, but it may regrow over time. And so the question is, are the U.S. and Israel going to be in a place where they sort of have to do this over and over and over again over a 4 or 5 year period to prevent Iran from reconstituting?
Let's talk a little bit about the rest of the neighborhood. You know, it was interesting to me that Iran's response, maybe seeing that the U.S. soldier and military targets were hardened, was to start lobbing bombs at hotels and airports and malls in neighboring Gulf states who were decidedly not part of the action. Now, you also saw, I saw in the Washington Post, you know, officially Saudi was saying, don't do anything. And according to the Post, I don't have any intel, but according to the Post, MBS was privately saying, yeah, go in there and get them. Was the decision, who made the decision, do you think, within Iran, as the regime just got decapitated, who made the decision to let's start going after Arab neighbors and go after soft civilian targets? And what's the theory of the case as to how that leads to anything good for Iran, as opposed to everybody in the regime agreeing, you know what, Israel, do your best?
So I think there's a two or three things going on here. One is just kind of a geographical factor. Drones, they're really not any good for going after Israel. They fly slow. You've got hours to intercept them. They can be intercepted by fighter jets and relatively unsophisticated capabilities. Like most of the drones that Iran launched at Israel in previous rounds of this didn't get through. They were essentially wasted. It's a lot easier to hit targets in the Gulf because if you're going after the UAE, particularly if you're launching from a part of Iran that's just across the Persian Gulf from the UAE, you're talking about minutes of warning time rather than hours. So that's one thing. I think the second thing is that in the run-up to this conflict, Iran made a conscious decision to decentralize command and control. The Iranian response back in June was essentially paralyzed for 24 or 48 hours. Because Israel killed a bunch of the commanders who would have authorized a response. So that's not happening to us again. So they decentralized authority downward, essentially to local commanders. And so a lot of what you saw, certainly in the first 48 hours of the conflict, was basically local commanders who had been told, when the war starts, you strike, right? You strike whatever your target is. But the important thing is to start generating action. And so to some degree, what we saw was less of a sort of coherent strategy than the Iranians just sort of trying to generate some action once they came under strain. But the third thing is, to the extent that there is a strategy, it is a strategy of indirect pressure. So the Iranians, you know, maybe they get lucky and they hit a U.S. facility like they did in Kuwait, where unfortunately they killed six U.S. service members.
See how big that.
But those are fairly hard targets. What they can do is hit softer targets, airports, hotels, data centers, energy infrastructure in neighboring countries. They can do a lot of damage to what I would call kind of Dubai Inc., right? And so the reputation of the UAE and Dubai in particular as an attractive place for tourism, a hub for international and intercontinental travel, right? A destination for investment and tech, because you've got stuff exploding all over the place. And then the theory goes, eventually, the leaders of the UAE and other Gulf states will go to President Trump and say, please, please make this stop by calling off the dogs, by calling a ceasefire in the war. Now, as you point out, Bruce, in attacking every country in the Persian Gulf, except maybe for Yemen, right, including Qatar and Oman, which are the two most Iran-friendly countries in the Gulf, they have earned a lot of enmity from their neighbors. And there is going to be a strategic cost to this. We saw, you know, even Qatar has carried out airstrikes against Iran, apparently. But I think the gamble is that this is their best hope to get Trump to call off the war before it becomes existential and perhaps fatal for the regime. So that's the race they're in with the United States.
The president, among other things, called for Iranian citizens to rise up, you know, all caps and Truth Social. Is that realistic and possible? You know, if you talk to me January 1st, the 30,000 likeliest to rise up, rose up and all got slaughtered. If I were in the region, whether it's after the first Gulf War or I wouldn't have a lot of confidence that somebody's got my back. And I'm not sure who would the leaders be. How would they be armed? There would be conflict. Is that a realistic potential scenario that they get replaced by a friendlier regime?
Well, maybe let's disaggregate this. So one, is it a realistic scenario that you get another uprising against the regime? And I think the answer is it's certainly possible, but it's unpredictable. It's possible because this regime is hated by most of the population, probably the significant majority of the population. That hatred has presumably only increased as a result of what happened in January. And so if there is a sense that the regime is mortally wounded or even that it's off balance, sure, it's possible that protesters will come back out in the streets. Now, the challenge is that the protesters are not particularly well organized and they're not armed. And they won't be armed.
Other than that, they're ready to go.
Yeah. Right? So they won't be armed until somebody arms them or until elements of the security services defect and go over to the other side and sort of open up the armories to them. This sometimes happens in revolutionary situations. The problem is that it's really hard to predict the circumstances under which that will happen. There's an old saying that every revolution is impossible until it becomes inevitable. In the sense that, you know, these things always seem like long shots and then they happen and we look back and we say, of course, that was what was destined to happen the entire time. And it's this sort of complex psychological calculation. You know, do I see what's happening and think, yeah, the regime is on its heels, this is my moment? Or do I look out and I say, I had five friends get killed when they went out in the streets in January. No thanks, not for me. Now, there are some reports in the media that a part of what you might call the Iranian opposition is armed. Kurdish groups, essentially, and that they may have been getting arms from, you know, Israel, maybe from other countries as well. And so there, the chances of an armed uprising might be better. And we've seen reports just in the media over the past couple of days that they basically said, we're getting ready to do this. You know, could you provide us with air support, which may be part of what's going on when you see the Israelis hitting police stations and things like that. Now, that can make the regime miserable. That is not what you would do if you were trying to get sort of a stable pro-U.S. Iran, because that runs headlong into Persian nationalism, which is a key thing in Iran as well. And so, you know, you put all those things together. The final question you asked is, does this lead to sort of a stable, more moderate regime? My guess is no. It could lead to a nightmare for the existing regime, right? If you have a population that comes back out in the streets at a time when the U.S. is still aggressively targeting regime control mechanisms, if you get violence in some of the Kurdish areas that's very hard to repress, like that makes Iran's job a lot harder. I don't know that it necessarily positions you for democracy on the other side.
So let's look to the north and west a little bit, our European allies and the geopolitical conversation. Not a lot of support, which could reflect a couple of different things. First, we didn't seemingly consult too many, as best the news reports suggest. So the idea that they're supposed to cheer when they weren't consulted, I understand. Some is often they don't want to get crosswise with people they worry could strike back against them or could cause some of the refugee populations in those countries to incite violence or terrorism. Not all of them necessarily love this president and how he has approached a lot of geopolitics, whether it's through trade or whether it's through perceived bullying of NATO. What's your take on the approach to Europe and what they didn't think there's any reason that everything was going hunky-dory or maybe they want to do business with Iran. What's your take on Europe, where they've been, where they are, and where they will be?
A few things here. So one is, I think there is sort of generalized concern that the U.S., as you pointed out, without much consultation with European allies, has launched a conflict and Europe may be asymmetrically exposed to the damage, right? And so Europe is asymmetrically exposed economically. And so energy prices in Europe have gone up more than they've gone up in the United States, for instance. And so there is a bit of frustration over that. There's also the fact that, Iran has targeted a couple of European countries, targeted the UK base on Cyprus, apparently launched a missile at Turkey, maybe not a European country, but a NATO member nonetheless, earlier today. And I think there is sort of just general frustration that the United States kind of did this without the normal garden tending alliance management that we've come to expect in dealing with the European allies in particular. Now, there are sort of two caveats to mention here. One is that the European approach to Iran has been getting more hard-edged in general in recent years and in recent months. And so the EU, I believe, declared the IRGC a terrorist organization not that long ago, which was a new step. The fact that Iran has now been taking sort of the shotgun approach to retaliation has exercised some European anger as well. And so I believe it's now finally confirmed that the Charles de Gaulle, the French aircraft carrier, is en route to the region to conduct sort of defensive mission, basically to help shoot down Iranian drones and missiles. The Brits, after initially denying the U.S. use of its bases for the strike, have sort of halfway reversed themselves since then in a way that seems designed to make absolutely no one happy. and then there are variations within the European response as well. So I was really struck by the fact that Friedrich Merz, the chancellor of Germany, was very supportive of U.S. policy. And he basically said, I'm paraphrasing a little bit here, but, who cares if this is against international law? This is a terrorist regime that needed to be dealt with. And the U.S. is the one that had the capabilities to do it. So great. And then on the other side, you have, waffling from the U.K., outright opposition from Spain. So there's a bit of a spectrum among European responses.
All right, Hal, let's compare and contrast this and 2003. With the invasion of Iraq. Obviously, the significant presence of ground forces is overwhelmingly the most, but the old Colin Powell line, "You break it, you bought it," leaps into my mind. That presumes, of course, that a leadership feels a responsibility. You could also break it and leave it if you chose to, but the worry Powell had is Iraq would end up the way Iraq kind of ended up. Help others see how does this not end that way? What's your sense when you look at Iraq versus Iran in 2003 and today?
Well, the cynical response is that we may make a mess here, but it's not going to be our mess. And I think Trump just does not believe it would make sense at all for the United States to take on the role of sort of providing on the ground security in a post-conflict Iran. Yes, he has sort of gestured in the past couple of days the idea that maybe we would use ground troops in some capacity. But Iran is a country that is significantly larger than Iraq, both in terms of geography and in terms of population. Like, there aren't enough people in the U.S. Army to occupy Iran in any meaningful fashion. So when Trump thinks about the future of Iran, I think scenario one in his mind, the ideal scenario is you find your Iranian Delcy Rodriguez, right? So this is somebody who will do business with the United States, who will sort of say, no, we never want nuclear weapons, who will maybe give the U.S. preferential access to the Iranian oil industry, and will basically do America's bidding, even though they may not change a whole lot in the way that Iran relates to its population. This could still be a pretty thuggish regime. And from Trump's perspective, that would be fine. And by the way, this is not just a Trump thing. This is a reversion to the historical norm for American statecraft. And so if you think back to the Cold War, what mattered to the United States was geopolitical and economic alignment. We were talking about countries in the third world, as we call it then. And what they did internally with or to their own populations, it wasn't beside the point, but it certainly wasn't the main point so far as U.S. policymakers were concerned. It's only in the past 30 or 40 years that we have front-loaded democracy and human rights and our dealings with countries sort of outside of the advanced democratic world in the way that we have. And I think Trump is sort of turning back the clock on that. There's a second scenario, which is that basically you get chaos in Iran after the fact. The regime is broken, but you have widespread violence. And I think in that case, Trump will simply say that that's not really our problem, right? As long as it is not affecting global energy markets in a way that is intolerable, as long as it's not sort of spewing violent instability throughout the region in a way that intersects with other American interests, I'll say this is for the Iranian people to sort out. And so I think what Trump has done is just sort of very explicitly reject, it was the Powell Doctrine or the Pottery Barn Doctrine. The U.S. is willing to use force in ways where we leave ourselves with far less back-end responsibility than we might have gotten used to in the days of Iraq and Afghanistan.
I've got a China question, a Russia question, but you're so fun to talk to on this stuff. Before I get to both of those, I want to actually get to just one of how warfare is changing. At the moment, we're using $4 million interceptors to knock out $20,000 drones. Now, I went to business school, law school, not business school. So maybe I missed, maybe I missed out on this, but that doesn't seem like the math doesn't math on that. How long can we, assuming there are weeks of needing to shoot down cheap things and the things we have to shoot them down are expensive things, what does it mean for our stockpiles? What does it mean for Ukraine? What does it mean for the potential defense of Taiwan and for the homeland? How do you see what's happening right now in Iran sort of consistent with what we've been seeing with Ukraine and Russia? And what does it mean for the current U.S. posture?
Yeah, so this is actually the subject of my next Bloomberg piece, which will be out, I think, maybe tomorrow or the next day. And you've identified, I think, which the critical choke point here. Some of the long-range standoff munitions we've been using, Tomahawk missiles and things like that, those are also scarce. The good news is that, we now have basically control of the skies of Iran. So you can just, like, fly over and drop more old-fashioned bombs, laser-guided, but sort of iron bombs. You don't need to use Tomahawk cruise missiles anymore. The air defense stuff is harder. There are the missile defenses, which are very effective but very expensive. And then there are the various air defenses that we use to take down drones. And as you mentioned, kind of the cost exchange ratio is not in our favor. And there were already shortages of these things, right? There were already shortages because of what we have given and sold to Ukraine over the years. There were already shortages relative most likely to what will be needed in a conflict with China in the Western Pacific. And now we're reaching the point where some of the key actors, including U.S. friends, are starting to run short of these interceptors. So part of the problem that the UAE has is that its stockpiles of these interceptors are low. And so what it's having to do is be much more selective in what it tries to shoot down and what it basically lets through. And so a lot of the stuff that's getting through isn't necessarily killing people, but you look on social media and stuff in the UAE is exploding, right? And that's bad from the perspective of the national brand there. And that will presume, if the Iranians are able to continue launching drones, that's going to continue to be a problem through the course of this conflict. Now, you mentioned Ukraine, and there's a flip side of this, which is that the Ukrainians have actually come up with much more cost-effective ways of shooting down drones, right? They use drones to go after drones. They use relatively unsophisticated capabilities to go after drones. They had to do that because they didn't have enough traditional air defense to take care of it. But as a result, they've become wonderfully creative about this stuff. And so there is a future where we can do counter-drone defenses in a much more cost-effective fashion than we do today. I'm not sure we can get there in the next 3 to 4 weeks, though.
All right. So my China question, this is something I've been toying with. I may try to get it to be my weekend Substack on this. But how much of this is about China? 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, I saw a Bloomberg cover of a UK Telegraph study that said China was going to be supplying anti-ship missiles to Iran. And we were building up, and it made me think, oh, wow, they're trying to get in front of what otherwise could be another Cuban missile crisis. Take down the regime before the resupply of things that would make it harder to take down the regime come in. And I also presumed it was a play by China to say, tell you what, we won't give Iran anti-ship missiles, and you don't sell all this stuff that you have slated to sell to Taiwan. That was my conspiracy theory about it all. Others have said, well, you know, how much of the oil from Iran goes to China? Although oil's fungible, it changes the price, but not necessarily the availability if you have the resources. What does all this mean for China in your estimation?
So I don't think the current war is primarily a China story and the way that some supporters of the Trump administration claim that it is. But I do think it is a China story to some degree. So kind of the ambitious version of this is sort of the road to Beijing runs through Tehran theory, where what the administration is doing is sort of systematically taking Beijing's chess pieces off of the global board. It is enhancing America's leverage over oil supplies, including in countries that exported heavily to China, Venezuela, and then Iran. And in doing so, you are building immense strategic leverage vis-a-vis China. By the way, you are also crippling China's inroads into the Middle East, and you are demonstrating that Chinese partnerships won't save you when the United States comes for you. I think this is like too clever by half, in part because, you know, China had sort of given up on Venezuela from a strategic perspective a few years ago. Chinese partnerships have never been mutual defense arrangements. China actually has pretty diversified relationships in the Persian Gulf with the UAE and Saudi and other countries. And, you know, what we saw in the case of Venezuela was that China just kind of backfilled by buying more oil from Russia, which is fine because it's still sanctioned oil. They still get it at a discount and actually deepens Russia's dependence on China. Now, there are some ways in which the current crisis is bad for China. And there are the folks who in the administration who sort of come at this from a geostrategic lens see these benefits, right? It is never good for Beijing when you see the U.S. use force effectively, efficiently, decisively in the way that at least tactically the U.S. has done over the past few days. If you do get a new regime in Iran, one that is sort of under U.S. tutelage, that creates a little bit of a bigger problem for China, because now you're talking about a country that provides, I think it's 12 or 13% of Chinese imports, as opposed to the roughly 4% that they got from Venezuela. A successful war would create some challenges for China. But there's a flip side of this, right? And it has to do with the readiness issues that we just talked about. And so if you're looking at this And you're seeing the U.S. blow through long-range precision strike stuff. You're seeing the U.S. blow through air and missile defenses. You're thinking, well, okay, this is going to give us greater leverage in the Western Pacific. And by the way, the Chinese are already making hay of this. They're already talking about how U.S. patrol flights in the South China Sea are down 30% month on month. Is that because of the current crisis? I don't know. But it shows you the way in which Beijing will try to make money out of this perception of American distraction, this view that the United States may say it's going to pivot to Asia, but it'll never actually happen.
All right, let's go to our next friend, Vladimir Putin. Is this good for Putin? The price of oil is going up. That's good for Putin. It seems like we're saying it's okay to decapitate a sovereign leadership, which feels like Putin's kind of thing. Weapons that might have gone to Ukraine are going to likely be used up defending against Iran and in the Middle East. Certainly our assets and our attention are being diverted. At the same time, he gets a lot of drones that whose factories are probably about to get annihilated, which is good. And one of his allies and near neighbors is about to potentially be a lot less reliable. So what are Vladimir Putin's calculations? And is he glad about this, or is this going to make him even more dangerous?
I think it's a mixed bag. I think that, you know, you mentioned the decapitation issue, which matters to Putin, but maybe from my perspective in a slightly different way. For Putin, like, this is a really worrying precedent. We know that Putin was horrified when Gaddafi was killed. And the idea that the world's most powerful country is going to go around, you know, kidnapping or helping to kill the leaders of hostile states, you know, surely that creates some degree of anxiety or anger in Putin. So he doesn't love that part of this crisis. If Iran is lost in the sense that the regime is toppled or it has to sort of change its geopolitical orientation to make peace with the United States, that causes some problems for Russia. You know, Russia has invested in this trade and transport corridor that basically runs through the Caspian down to Iran and from there on to Asia as an alternative to traditional transit routes that are more subject to interdiction by the United States. And so Putin would not like to see that investment devalued. My understanding is that the Russians, it was basically a technology transfer arrangement. So the Russians make a lot of the suicide drones that now that once might have been imported from Iran. So I don't know how much of a loss there is there. There are some areas where this is good for Putin. And I think you mentioned a number of them. So one, if the U.S. doesn't have air and missile defenses in adequate capacity, it's presumably going to sell less of those things to the Europeans who've been giving them to Ukraine. Two, U.S. attention will be drawn away from Ukraine. Three, the price of Russian oil, even the discounted stuff, has spiked. I think I saw that, you know, Urals was up to sort of like $59 as opposed to $39 as of a couple of days ago. So that's a bump for the Russian war economy. And that's good because they've been running into strains there. Good from Putin's perspective, at least. And so I think he'll find some sense of advantage from this crisis in the way that it, you know, it's usually good for Russia when the U.S. is distracted elsewhere. But there are some things about this that I think are either already or potentially pretty worrying for Putin.
All right, my last question. I've got lots more, but I always try to keep these at roughly 40-ish minutes to make it more or less a drive-home podcast length. A piece that certainly a lot of our clients are really interested in. The military has increasingly been leveraging AI. They used AI in the Maduro raid, and the AI that they have preferred, very effective, is Anthropic's AI. Literally on the eve of the attacks, you hear the Department of War and the president more or less say, we hereby excommunicate Anthropic. We're not only going to not use them because we don't like the restrictions they want to put on our capacity to use their models, but we're going to declare them a supply chain risk. So we might in the near future not do business with people who themselves do business with Anthropic, which presumably the Department of Defense likes and is not a national security problem that they identified. What is your take on, and they gave themselves at least 6 months to unwind it, so it shouldn't have any impact on the immediate term, but what is your take on the significance of that, both how critical AI and the existing AI and the substitutability of models are for the military and their real-time operations, but also what it means for those who want to work with the military and supply and support them?
So thing one is sometimes you can't make this stuff up. And so, you know, literally on Friday afternoon, the U.S. government brings the hammer down on Anthropic. And on Saturday morning, it uses Anthropic to carry out strikes against Iran, which illustrates thing two, which is just how pervasive Anthropic models are within the U.S. national security community. And a lot of this is presumably happening behind the classification door. But we know that the Pentagon relies heavily on Anthropic. We know that a lot of Pentagon contractors rely heavily on Anthropic. And so if you are really trying to basically cut Anthropic out of the defense ecosystem, that one, that's going to take a while. Two, it's going to come at a capability decrement, because I think in general, the view is that Anthropic does better than many of its competitors. And three, it's sort of out of step at a time when what the Pentagon has been saying is we've got to accelerate adoption of AI because it's so mission critical across all of these fields. So, you know, where is this going to go? Part of me suspects that there will be some sort of deal that gets worked out over this 180-day period, because one, this is going to be a real problem for the U.S. government if they're really done with Anthropic. And two, this is potentially existential for Anthropic if the U.S. government is done with them, depending on how broadly the supply chain risk label is interpreted. So I wouldn't be shocked if we come to some sort of compromise here. I think also, candidly, Anthropic does not have the best position on the merits of this dispute for reasons we can go into. And so it may incentivize them to try to find a way out of this as well. But the second kind of big and concluding point, I guess, is that I worry this is going to unwind a non-trivial amount of progress that the U.S. national security community has made in working with Silicon Valley over the past 8 or 9 years. You know, I'm old enough to remember, you know, when you had this blow up at Google over working with DOD back in, I believe it was, what, 2017 or 2018? And, you know, DOD under a bunch of different administrations, three different administrations, has now made a concerted effort to try to sort of overcome the cultural gulf between the Bay Area and Washington, D.C. And if you're now in a situation where the government is going to try to basically put Anthropic out of business over this dispute, you know, whatever the merits are, you could end up with a much more fraught or at least divided relationship where you have sort of some firms that are Trump friendly and are government friendly, other firms that are seen to be not Trump friendly or not government friendly. And I just don't think that's good for the U.S. writ large when we think about how critical AI adoption is going to be in the national security space.
Well, there's a ton more to talk about. We're not going to do it right here and now. People who, like me, are overwhelmingly impressed by Hal should A, follow him on Bloomberg, B, join us on the 30th of March when we're going to reconvene. I'll send heads up in advance, probably 4 p.m. That's my usual preferred time, although Hal's a popular guy. And then last, Hal, for anybody who wants to have you as a paid speaker or appearance to kind of do an armchair conversation about this real-time, really relevant stuff, what's the right way for them to reach out? Do you have an agency? Is it you directly? Am I now your guy? Like, who do you want people to pin if they want to try to hire
send
you?
All speaking inquiries to Bruce Melman. No, you can just contact me directly. I've got a site on the web with my email address and everything. So just shoot me an email and we can see where it goes.
Hal Brands, thanks for illuminating so much of this for us. And I look forward to seeing you on the 30th.
Great to see you, Bruce. It's always a pleasure to join you for these things.
Thanks, everybody.